From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US Supreme Court smashes the ceiling on political campaign contributions in a ruling critics say will put US elections up for sale.
This is America for the highest bidder, authorized by our highest court. What a very sad moment. It's time for citizens to stand up and say enough.
Also today, the 19-year-old student who escaped violence and persecution in Mauritius but is now being deported by the UK despite nationwide outcry. And the unprecedented outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus continues to claim lives across Western Africa.
There's a lot of hemorrhaging, and ultimately for those who die, there's organ failure. So very severe symptoms and highly infectious.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. In a landmark ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court says limits on the amount of money individuals can donate to American political campaigns are unconstitutional. The decision means record amounts of money will now be raised by candidates seeking election to the U.S. Congress and the presidency. Washington correspondent Simon Marks says it's one of the most important Supreme Court decisions in decades.
This is a seismic decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. It essentially signals that big money will not only continue to pollute America's political system, but that the cash will now be allowed to flow in an unrestricted way. By 5-4, the justices have rolled back attempts to control the amount of money flushing through America's political system by at least 2 decades. The judgment means candidates running for office later this year in midterm elections or in the 2016 race for the U.S. presidency will inevitably now seek to raise record amounts of money for their campaigns.
Chile's army has been sent to recapture 300 inmates that escaped from prison after an 8.2 magnitude earthquake hit the northern region of the country. Chile's President Michelle Bachelet has declared disaster areas in the northern cities of Arica, Parinacota, and Tarapacá. Andrea Arenas has the details.
Chile's army has arrived in the northern city of Iquique, one of the most affected by the earthquake that shook the region Tuesday night. Troops in that city have been tasked with recapturing some 300 prisoners who escaped from a women's jail after the earthquake struck. So far, authorities have confirmed they have detained over 24 of them. Authorities have also confirmed at least 6 deaths so far from the earthquake. Thousands of people across northern Chile were forced to evacuate as a precaution to the tsunami alert. Across the region, in Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, and Panama, people were also affected as a tsunami alert was put in place for several hours.
The ousted president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, has called Crimea's annexation from Ukraine a tragedy. In his first interview to Russian and U.S. media channels since he fled to Russia in late February, Mr. Yanukovych said he would have preferred to see Crimea become more independent but remain Ukrainian. Daria Bandarchuk reports from FSN's Moscow Bureau.
Viktor Yanukovych spoke to the Associated Press and the Russian TV channel NTV from the city of Rostov-on-Don in southern Russia. The former Ukrainian president stated he would have fought to keep Crimea within Ukraine had he been in power. He also assured that he did not give police orders to shoot at pro-European protesters during mass riots in Kyiv in February. The ousted politician once again put the legitimacy of the upcoming presidential elections in Ukraine set for May 25 under question. Viktor Yanukovych and former members of his government were put on Ukraine's wanted list. The US and Europe have introduced sanctions against him for misusing of state funds and violating human rights.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The US government says the path forward for the Middle East peace talks will not be easy. Following moves by the Palestinian president, many observers feel the American mediated talks are on life support, if not outright dead. Priscilla Huff reports.
It's not easy now. That's the assessment of the White House on the future of talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But the Obama administration remains steadfast in its assessment that it is in the interest of both parties to try to find a path forward to reach a peace agreement. For now, that path may have reached a dead end after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas signed the paperwork to join 15 international organizations and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry canceled a third trip to the region. For now, the U.S. appears to be pushing the responsibility on the Israelis and Palestinians, saying it's up to the parties to decide what they want to do for the future and for peace.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has warned of a very grave situation on the Korean Peninsula. A surge in military tensions has seen the two Koreas trade artillery fire, and Pyongyang has threatened a new nuclear test. Kate Fisher has more.
North Korea's official KCNA news agency quoted Kim Jong-un as saying the current situation is very grave. In a meeting with top military leaders on Tuesday, he blamed Washington and Seoul for the current frictions, saying they had trampled on peace overtures from Pyongyang. Kim told his senior officers that the North Korean military and people will never tolerate the US policy of hostility and will crush it thoroughly. Just a month ago, inter-Korean relations had appeared to be enjoying something of a thaw when the two rivals held rare high-level talks.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The US Supreme Court today opened the floodgates for cash donations from individuals towards election campaigns. By a narrow 5-4 vote, the High Court struck down limits on how much individuals can give to federal candidates and political parties during an election cycle. Republican-appointed justices overturned the donation limit on the grounds it was unconstitutional. Opponents of today's Supreme Court decision said it would lead to the unfettered purchase of US elections. Earlier, I spoke to Barbara Lawton, President and CEO of Americans for Campaign Reform, and began by asking her about the significance of today's ruling.
What happened today, the Supreme Court decided to overturn 40 years of national policy and 38 years of a judicial decision that recognized that there were opportunities for and the danger of government corruption in the amount in money coming into our system. And they decide to overturn that. So it has a tremendous impact where we could limit the aggregate contributions in a election cycle. I could give a maximum of $123,000 or so. Now I could find my way, if I had it in my pocket, to give more than $1 million. This is a wild unleashing of the influence of money and big donors who become positioned now in a very direct way to reshape the American economy in their own interest.
But the Chief Justice is today argued that to not allow that would be unconstitutional.
They did, and that reversed a court decision that said actually to protect the integrity and the confidence in our democracy and to prevent corruption 38 years ago, it was decided that those limits actually were constitutional. So we can see this as an activist court making that decision. But this is not partisan. I mean, people will talk about the overriding conservative nature of this court in terms of their political ideology. But this isn't a Republican or a Democratic issue. This is an American issue. And luckily, there is a way for us to begin to address this, even as we're wallowing in a sense of being abandoned by our court, by our president who hasn't shown leadership on this, by the governor of New York. But there are bills that are in both houses of our Congress that would bring about a system of small donor public funding of campaigns that would actually allow us to start right at the core where we can put the politicians in a direct relationship with their voters and make votes matter more than money.
Barbara, you've run for office, so you have firsthand experience of the grubby world of election of election financing. What did you encounter when you went through this process?
What I realized is that if you were running for office, that there was in running collecting enough money to run a viable and competitive campaign, that there was almost no way for you to do it without creating, at the very least, the appearance of selling access to you once you were in office. spending hours a day on the phone begging for money from complete strangers, I can tell you, diminishes your soul. But then when you get into office and people assume that if they have given you $1,000 or $10,000, that you ought to answer the phone for them. And in fact, you can see that that happens. I've watched it from the inside, and I've seen it play from the outside when you ask people for money, what they seem to be asking back or insinuating in a quid pro quo. And that's exactly what's at stake in this, that we need to shift the balance back to the voters and the balance of power, so that we can see, for instance, in New York City, where they've had 25 years of a small donor public financing program, that now the contributions come from the district to the candidates. And the candidates actually have to speak to the people who will elect them with their votes, instead of those people being targeted by big campaign ads and big money deciding what happens once someone is in office.
Is this America for sale to the highest bidder?
Yes. This is America for sale to the highest bidder, authorized by our highest court. What a very sad moment. It's time for citizens to stand up and say enough.
Barbara Lawton, President and CEO of Americans for Campaign Reform. This is FSN Reports. A 19-year-old Mauritian student is due to be deported from the United Kingdom tonight, despite an emotional plea from her mother in the British Parliament and a petition with hundreds of thousands of signatures. Yashika Bagarati's family came to the UK claiming asylum from an abusive relative, but now she's legally an adult. The British government is deporting her. British Airways have already refused to take her on one of their flights, but she is due to leave on an Air Mauritius flight imminently. FSN's Kate Fisher reports.
19-year-old Yashika Bagarathi is at Heathrow Airport in London. Her school says that she's under armed guard and that we can't speak to her because her phone has been taken from her. Her school's deputy principal, Zoe Thompson, says the student is terrified.
But right now, she's feeling really lonely. She's scared. She's petrified. And she doesn't know what to do. We're not able to contact her anymore. Her phone has been taken away. She was allowed one call when she called us just to say, can we help? Is there anything that we could do to help her and potentially save her life?
Yashika's mother is also distraught. After hearing the British Immigration Minister say he wouldn't intervene to stop the deportation, she broke down in tears in an interview with the UK's ITV News.
That is not a place for her over there. Her place is in the school with her friends, with his teachers. She misses her school a lot. The education, everything. Every time she's saying, I'm not a criminal, to lock me here.
Her case has widespread public support, especially from her school, the Oasis Academy in London. Its founder, Steve Chalk, says they're doing everything they can to stop the deportation.
We've mobilised a huge petition, over 200,000 names now, in support of this girl, who only has a couple of months to run on her A-level course. She's going to be separated from her family. She's a young lady. She's a brilliant student. But the point is, she's very, very vulnerable.
This is the third attempt to send Yashika back to Mauritius in little over a week. Editor of politics.co.uk, Ian Daunt, reports on immigration cases and has been following Yashika's story. He says that if commercial airlines continue to refuse to take her, the government may charter a plane. A last-ditch attempt to stop her flight is being staged at Heathrow.
Lots of calls are taking place now for Air Mauritius, who are supposed to be doing the flight, to halt it. That has been successful in the past. A few days ago, actually, Air Mauritius decided against carrying out the Home Office's request for a deportation. And British Airways certainly gave up on trying to fly her back on a previous request by the Home Office for the same reason. So there is a sustained campaign that's happened. There are people gathering at Heathrow to try and stop it. it's unclear whether those efforts will be successful.
If they're not, her teacher, Zoe Thompson, says that Yashika's life is at risk.
We fear the worst. Yashika's would be returning to a very dangerous situation that has been heightened in recent weeks. She has received many death threats and calls for her to remain here because she's not safe going home. We feel the worst.
With no further legal recourse open to her, Rashika now faces an uncertain future, thousands of miles from her family and friends. Kate Fisher, FSN reports.
At least 80 people have now died as an Ebola epidemic continues to take hold in West Africa. The outbreak had centred around a remote southeastern region of Guinea and has since spread to neighbouring states. The virus, which causes severe bleeding, is incurable and has humanitarian aid groups struggling to contain the spread of infection. I discussed the outbreak with Donna A. Patterson, a professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, Massachusetts, and asked her why the epidemic was so unprecedented.
One of the reasons that it's been considered unprecedented is because there's never been an outbreak in the West African sub-region. And while in some cases the numbers have been higher in other places, there hasn't been this outbreak, and it's moving very rapidly. And I think, too, what's interesting to know is where it's situated within the sub-region. When I saw the Ebola outbreak in Guinea near the borders of Liberia and Sierra Leone, I became concerned about it spreading to other countries in the sub-region and beyond. You know, it's very unprecedented to see it moving into places like Guinea-Conakry, which is the capital, that has 2 million people in it.
So why are we seeing this pattern of infection?
People suspect that it probably came from another region. There are two possibilities. Some say that it may have come from another region, and some are saying that it may be transmitted by bats in the region. I think that the main reason that we're seeing it transmitted in this way in the region is because there's so much movement. There's so much movement, definitely when you're at borders, where the outbreak occurred, and Guinea was right near the borders of Liberia and Sierra Leone. So you're already looking at three countries. And we already know that it has spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone. Western media is saying that there have been two confirmed cases in Liberia. However, the Senegalese government saying that there are 6 confirmed cases in Liberia and there are another 8 presumed cases in Sierra Leone. We know that there are a number of cases given that its location where it began, but also the movement now to the capital.
Can you explain why this particular virus is so notorious in terms of the symptoms and the treatment, if there is an effective treatment?
There is no treatment. One can treat some of the symptoms, but there is no vaccine. There is no cure. So effectively, one's body either fights it or doesn't fight it.
And what is the body fighting?
What is it fighting? A number of things. It starts off with flu-like symptoms, which is tricky because people often mistake it for something else. They may mistake it as the flu, or maybe a tropical disease that has some of those symptoms. And so often it's spread maybe to healthcare workers and family members before they realize what's going on. And then the symptoms progress. There's a lot of hemorrhaging, and ultimately for those who die, there's organ failure. So very severe symptoms and highly infectious. It is spread through secretions. One may be eating in a communal way, or if someone dies in terms of preparing your body for funeral and coming in contact with secretions, even after they've died, the disease can still be transmitted.
It's a rather bleak outlook, isn't it? And certainly in terms of treatment, well, there's obviously no cure, and this is a very aggressive virus. Can you sort of understand how the humanitarian efforts, those medical professionals on the ground in West Africa, what they're up against? How can they possibly contain this?
They're trying. I mean, Guinea has now closed its borders in terms of, the movement of people in and out. But one has to remember that borders in West Africa are still porous. Senegal has closed its borders. They've closed their borders with Guinea. What they're also doing, the Senegalese government, is they've strengthened security at all of the borders, so not only in Guinea, but also land, sea, and air. And so they're being very cautious, and they're checking people because there are still flights, you know, between Conakry and Dakar. And so they're looking at people at the airport and trying to make sure that, you know, if someone comes in with Ebola, that they go and they isolate them right away to try to stop the disease from coming into the country.
Donna A. Patterson, Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Now, Ségolène Royal, the former partner of French President François Hollande, has joined the government in a major socialist reshuffle. She'll serve as Environment Minister under the country's new Prime Minister, Manuel Valls. The move comes after an embarrassing defeat at local elections for France's Socialist Party. Polls show record levels of unpopularity for President Hollande, and much of that unpopularity is due to the country's ailing economy, as Ollie Barrett reports from Paris.
As spring arrives in the French capital, it's hard to ignore a sense of gloom when it comes to economic matters. Ben McPartland is the editor of news website The Local France.
The mood, in one word, you would say glum. They're down on themselves, you know, in terms of the economy, in terms of their place in the world, in terms of, the globalization, you know. It's not just the record high unemployment and the economy that's struggling, 1% growth, I think, predicted for this year. It's all the talk of French leaving to go abroad to find happier financial climes in the United States, in the Far East, in Australia, even in Britain.
However, while President François Hollande is either unwilling or unable to pass domestic economic reforms that his critics say are needed to boost French competitiveness, there are those who believe with interventions in Africa and an increase in diplomacy, he is boosting France on the international scene. Among them, emerging economies analyst Jean-Joseph Boyau.
Whenever you are president, you don't manage only the short term. You try also to have a vision. And on that, I do believe that President Hollande, more and more, is focusing on international issues. He tried to bet on this mindset in France, that France still is a global player. On the long term, I think that President Hollande has made a good choice. He need to travel abroad. He need to secure the position of France as a global power.
And there are international businesses out there who do still see France as an attractive place to invest. Yu Xiaotong is CEO of a Chinese-French economic cooperation zone being built in Châteauroux in the centre of France.
First of all, recently there are many of Chinese companies want to go abroad, and for European market is very attractive. And secondly, during the last world crisis, financial crisis, and the European economy not fully recovery, they need Chinese investors to help European to recover from the financial crisis. So I think it's very important for both sides.
However, unemployment remains over 10%, with youth unemployment around 25%. Ben McPartland says many French don't believe François Hollande and his reshuffled government can turn things around.
The state of the French economy is obviously not all to blame on Hollande. You know, it's been in the doldrums for a few years now, but he doesn't seem to be able to convince the French public that he's the one who can, you know, set the boat straight again, you know, and pull the economy out of the hole, create jobs, decrease this huge public deficit. So then they're not entirely convinced by him.
The French economy has stabilised somewhat as some other European nations begin to return to growth. And Germany, for example, appears in fine economic health. But much work will have to be done for France to shake off a label beginning to stick as the new sick man of Europe. Ollie Barrett, Paris.
And finally tonight, a number of foreign correspondents who were covering South Africa more than 20 years ago have felt compelled to return this year to witness democracy's 20-year milestone. Our Washington correspondent, Nina Maria Potts, spoke to a couple of American reporters about their experiences of covering South Africa and their take on how much the country has changed since the fall of apartheid.
For many foreign correspondents who covered South Africa in the 1980s and early 90s, marking 20 years of democracy means a great deal. Steve Muffson covered apartheid South Africa for the Wall Street Journal from 1984 to 1986, including two states of emergency. And he wrote a book about the black uprisings of the 1980s called Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. In May 1987, the government refused to renew his work permit and expelled him from the country. It took him 26 years to go back, and when he did, he found South Africa profoundly changed, an experience he wrote about in the Washington Post, where he's a staff writer.
And it was extraordinary being back. I mean, coming from the United States, you know, we have a lot of hang-ups about race here. And in some ways, I felt like, from an attitude point of view, South Africa had made more progress in 20 years than the United States made over a century or more.
Despite being accused by the apartheid regime of depicting a negative image of South Africa to the outside world, Steve Muffson says he was always optimistic about the country's future.
The foundations for a new South Africa were all there in the 1980s. Independent press, a fairly independent judiciary, community organizations in which people came together, determined priorities, often negotiated with white authorities, learned to compromise.
Not everyone was so certain that democracy would take hold. For Geraldine Eddings, an African-American reporter for the Baltimore Sun, in 1990 there were no guarantees of which way the country would go.
The South Africa that I covered as a journalist in 1990 was, we felt, was constantly on the verge of cataclysm. You know, no one knew if there would be a huge bloody civil war. No one knew if the country would blow up. Businesses were pulling out. People were afraid. And there was violence that really everybody at the time figured might at any point escalate into something that the country couldn't turn back from. So the South Africa today has overcome that.
Today, Geraldine Eddings heads up the International Center for Journalists Africa programs, helping to train and protect journalists on the ground continent-wide. As a young black reporter, she experienced the brutal side of the apartheid regime firsthand, until people would realize that she was an American.
My accent, it flipped a switch so that suddenly I was no longer a black person who was being greeted by perhaps white South Africans with attitudes about black people, but I was an American.
For many U.S. correspondents covering South Africa's democratic transition, the chance to report the truth from the inside was a privilege they'll never forget. Again, Geraldine Eddings.
You had the freedom to move around as a foreign correspondent that you did not have as a South African journalist.
That two-way process underpins the world's best international reporting, according to the Newseum, which from the heart of Washington serves to protect press freedoms around the world. Jean Polosinski of the Newseum Institute says foreign correspondents play an essential role in bringing stories to the surface for people back home.
One of the things that I think foreign correspondents can do is bring that view both into the country of here's a different way to do it or a different perspective, and then take back to their own countries the opportunity perhaps to observe and learn from newer and innovative societies.
South Africa's first democratic elections hold a special place in the minds of many U.S. foreign correspondents who were deployed to report on history in the making. And there's still a real admiration for how far South Africa has come. For FSN Reports, I'm Nina Maria Potts in Washington.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact the show, you can email us at reports@featurestory.com or find us on Twitter at @featurestory. Coming up on Thursday, as a Senate panel prepares to vote on declassifying parts of a report on the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation, we hear from a former interrogator who says torture is not only wrong, but ineffective. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.